Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, and I'll be talking today with David Hennig, who is an associate professor of cultural anthropology at Utrecht University. David's new book is called Remaking Muslim Lives, Everyday Islam in Postwar Bosnia and Herzegovina, and this is published in 2020 by the University of Illinois Press. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Steven. Thank you for having me.
So a little bit about David Hennig. He earned his PhD in social anthropology from Durham University in the UK, and he also held appointments at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London and the University of Kent. He's edited the journal History and Anthropology since 2015. In his book, which we'll talk about today, Remaking Muslim Lives, David's work explores how people remake their life worlds in the wake of dramatic societal ruptures. His published research has been focused broadly on conflict and coexistence, violence and memory, Muslim politics, revival and transnational mobility, post-socialism, charity, informal economies, military waste, and everyday diplomacy and geopolitics. He's carried out extensive field work, I'm really impressed by this, in Bosnia and Herzegovina and rural spaces especially, and studied the transformation of political economy and the reconfiguration of religious institutions and practices in the face of political ruptures. So his book today, it has resulted in, or has been included in a lot of different journals, many articles, special issues. I'm really happy to talk with him today about Remaking Muslim Lives. So let's start, David, if we can, with your field work. Can you talk about when you started your field work in Bosnia-Herzegovina and what led you to do it?
Sure. So maybe I will start with the second part of your question. So I have been interested probably for the last 20 years or so in the ways in which religion re-emerged, religious life re-emerged in the post-socialist context. And I have traveled to various parts of the region, not only Bosnia, but I also went to the Caucasus, Dagestan, and other places. So I've been thinking about this for a really long time. And Bosnia is partly a sort of serendipity and partly just an interest in a particular place where I eventually conducted my fieldwork that is usual and unusual at the same time, because the place I talk about in my book has experienced not only the socialist rupture and the rupture related to the war, but it's also a place that has a long continuity of religious practice that is connected to the arrival of the Ottomans, actually, to the region. So my fieldwork started in 2008, and I've been coming back and forth basically between Bosnia and wherever I've been based since 2008 until present.
So my questions for you in doing this field work are about place, and then I would say about the people. Mm-hmm. Now, you have a particular region in central Bosnia, and you have a village, as far as I understand, which is fictional, but it's based on all of your work, and it's a Muslim-only village of about 250 inhabitants. Could you describe that to our readers? What is this place like?
Sure. I started this project in one particular village, but from the beginning, I've been interested more in the whole area. So the area is called the Zvezda Highlands. Zvezda actually means a sort of star. So because the highlands have a sort of star shape, like horizon, at least that's how it looks like from the village where I was based. And I traveled extensively across the region and spent a lot of time in various villages. They are all very, very similar. I would say that villages in this region look very much like many villages across Eastern European countryside. So experiences with sort of socialist sort of experiments in economy, and of course the post-socialist slash post-war landscape, many empty houses, many destroyed houses, high level of unemployment, and increasingly out migration from the region as well. Everyday life in these places is first and foremost a struggle to get by for everyone, and people try to find their ways, as I describe in the book. So various forms of informal economy, various forms of very precarious jobs, mainly in the timber industry, and of course a significant number of villagers also rely on the pension benefits that are related to war injuries as well.
Yeah, and I mean, the statistics about unemployment are quite stunning. Almost 60%, right? Or 6 out of 10 men. Yeah. What's the situation with precarity? How's that, let's say, evolved since the 1960s modernization, and then, of course, after the Dayton Accords?
Yeah. This is a great question, because one thing I'm trying to do in the book is to present not a sort of snapshot of 1 year that I would spend in the village, but I really try to trace much sort of longer historical sort of continuities in these villages. Post Second World War experiences in these villages are sort of the early process of modernization that came with Tito. So there are very lively memories of the first schools being opened in the villages, first roads being built in the late 60s, first opportunities for male villagers to go working abroad as gastarbeiters in Germany. So there has been a lot of transnational labor mobility since the 60s. And since the 70s, when the flow of workers to Germany decreased, so the new opportunities in the Middle East, and that's where also, for example, the Muslim context comes into it in an interesting way, also opened. So quite a few villagers from the region spent some time in Iraq, in Libya, and in other places in the Middle East. In the 80s, a significant number, so another generation basically of villagers, started working in the factories that were producing Volkswagen cars nearby Sarajevo. Mm-hmm. So again, the kind of interesting German Yugoslav connection there. What happened afterwards is again a sort of typical story that obviously during the war there was no production in this regard, but after the war, what followed is a rapid privatization, like in other places across Eastern Europe, as communist Europe, where basically very non-transparent privatization factories basically went bankrupt, expensive equipment stolen. And it then affected villagers because they lost these job opportunities. So what is emerging in the early 2000s as a sort of typical feature of many villages in this region is first sort of private sawmill factories, little sort of factories. Usually every village has at least one, but again the opportunity for people to work there is that it's a very random, precarious job without any insurance, health insurance, pension insurance, and usually officially 3 to 5 people work there, but in fact it could be up to 15 to 20. But the level of unemployment is still very high, and this is also one of the many reasons why so many people are leaving the villages for good, as I also talk about in the book.
Yeah. Could you introduce for us your chapter? So I know that you have two parts, and it's an interesting question for me about land and property. You start with, you have a lot of interlocutors, but you start with a chapter called Houses in Flames. Mm-hmm. And so could you talk about how you arranged the book in the two parts about experience and piety and exchange, and what were the choices you made?
Yeah. So, so I should probably begin with that. Obviously, the book as such, the project started with my interest in the anthropology of religion, and in particular, anthropology of pilgrimage and ritual, and you know, the usual things that anthropologists study. And but since my arrival to the region and to these villages, I realized that I can't ignore all these other things we've been talking about so far. So then it became also a challenge how to integrate these kind of aspects of everyday life, if you will, the religious and the political economy aspect of everyday life together. So the book is divided into, as you said, two parts. The first one is called Making and Unmaking Village Lives. And the second part is called Vital Exchange, which is a way in which I try to write about the lived experience of religion. So in the first part, I pay more attention to the transformation of political economy as it is experienced on the ground in the villages. So I look from the perspective of individual households first, then I move to the level of neighborhoods and sociality outside of sort of kinship relations. And the third chapter in this part is looking into the wider area of what we could call moral economy in the village, that somehow sort of reflects both the family relationships, the social relationships outside of family, into a sort of wider context of a very sort of neoliberal economy of the Bosnian state, and the ways in which people sort of try to navigate that. And of course, they make, and that's one of the important things, thing I try to show in the book, is that people do make sense to these changes in the language, imaginings of social, of religious experience. Yeah? So the vocabulary that they themselves kind of use to make sense of these things is kind of drawn from, let's say, religious vocabulary. Which is
Go ahead. I'd like to sort of go through some of the chapters step by step. So, I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I was just thinking about the way that you conceptualize the rural, especially in the in the first part of the book, because mm-hmm. as you say, you're covering political economy, but it's also moral economy. Mm-hmm. And I think you're dealing in many really interesting ways with the stereotypes that even anthropologists have carried about the rural as parochial and isolated and somehow cut off. So I wonder if you could introduce that through your stories. Could you give us an idea of some of your interlocutors and how you actually get inside of both the political economy and the moral economy of these areas?
Yeah. So as you said, what I try to show in the book is that, well, what is interesting, I'll put it that way. What is interesting is that as you can imagine, there has been quite a lot published on places like Bosnia, but very little actually about what we could call rural lives or rural areas of these places in the post-war/post-socialist context, which is really interesting. Firstly, compared with other places in Eastern Europe, but it's also interesting in regard to the fact that the rural life or rural areas constitute more than still half of the population, actually. And I think that partly the reason for that is that there is in anthropology a certain, attitude towards studying rural areas in the present, which basically is that it is associated exactly with what you said, something very isolated, cut off, you know, these bigger sort of flows and things that are happening in the world, that anthropologists, and it is true in the past, often studied villages as isolated, bounded places, mm-hmm. kind of cut off these external processes and affairs. But what I try to show in the book is that a village is a perspective on these global transformations. So right. These places are remote in certain imagination. That's true. For some people, but villagers don't see it as being cut off or remote from these affairs. So I do actually start the book, for example, with this story of a friend of mine who is an elderly villager in his early 60s, who kind of walks me through the landscape, through the village landscape, through the fields that have belonged to his family for many generations. And at one moment, he's kind of staring at the horizon as we are talking about random things. And he's telling me, Bosnia is like a badly parked car.
yes.
It has great always metaphor. Obstructed somewhere and somebody. So what can we do? We must live and look ahead. And then he sort of added, inshallah, yeah, God willing, everything will be fine. So kind of merging on the one hand, these, let's say, different sensibilities, sort of pious sensibility and very kind of conscious geopolitical sensibility to the position of Bosnia as a place, meaning both his village, but also the country where all these experiences, like with the Ottomans, the First World War, Second World War, Cold War, neoliberal transformations, they are all somehow part of the landscape on where we were walking and moving through. So this is very much sort of part of lived experience. So villagers themselves don't see as being cut of these wider transformations, and that's also something I try to show in these different chapters.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to turn really there. I think that's a good opportunity for us to talk about Islam and Muslims in Southeast Europe. So, you know, I mean, you start with certain stereotypes like Ernest Gellner, how he was wrong. I think he was wrong about many things regarding religious experiences. But what really impresses me about your book is how you get beyond the world of official piety, or I don't know if it would be called institutional piety in the villages, but you have a rich glossary with so many different words on neighborhood, on care, on mutuality. So could you maybe introduce how you approach the study of religious practices, especially at the village level in mm-hmm. part one? How did you do that?
Well, the easiest thing would be to say that I do listen and observe what people do and what matters to them. But that's a kind of textbook answer that probably you would hear from, you know, sort of yeah. anthropological research methods. So what does it mean in practice? Well, I think what was really important for me from the very beginning was that when I started reading about places, about Islam in Southeast Europe, I would say 99% or 98, I don't know, of the literature, of the debates is about identity, yeah, Muslim identity, that everything has to be basically about Muslim identity. And what it means in places like Bosnia in practice is that it's a study of how people understand themselves as different from others, meaning Christians, Orthodox, or Croats, or Serbs. But that wasn't something that would be a matter of the sort of everyday concern. That's not how, for example, piety is understood or articulated. What is everyday concern is how to live, how to be a certain kind of person. And this was the starting point for me. So rather than asking who I am in terms of identity, I was sort of listening or trying to listen and observe rather how people sort of find a practical answer to the question how to live and what kind of vocabularies, practices people employ to sort of answer to this question. And that's where all these concepts that you mentioned started emerging.
Could you introduce some of them? I mean, you have sevap, right?
Sevap, yeah. Yeah.
What are some of these ethical practices? I mean, some are along the five pillars of Islam, right? But what are they?
So for example, I write quite a lot about what we can call the economy of good deeds, which is a very important. That's the concept of sevap. And it basically refers to a range of acts, practices, whereby you just perform, do good deeds without any particular sort of interest or calculation in mind. So I give these examples of, you know, a friend of mine who is also a beekeeper. When his bees, when there's a good season, and he has enough honey to put aside for his family and to sell to make a little bit of profit, then part of the yields are distributed in the neighborhood for free because it's a gift from Allah.
Right.
So you share it. So it's a type of economy of sharing, for example. Or if you happen to have a tractor in the village and there is a heavy snowfall, then you just take your tractor without asking and you just go and just clean the streets because you do it for others. So these are the sort of everyday acts that people perform. But there are other types of good deeds, such as praying for the souls of your dead relatives, praying for the souls of the martyrs who died during the war, and so on. So it also kind of unfolds at different scales and different contexts of everyday life. But this is an important one. Another one I write quite extensively about in the book is the practice of Dova, which can mean various things, but in general it means prayer. But again, prayer in the sort of context of life experience, life religious experience, has multiple meanings. So it doesn't only refer to five daily prayers, but it can also refer that you just pass on the way to the forest, the local cemetery, right, and you stop and you pray for the souls of the dead there, because it earns not only good deeds to your preparation for afterlife, but it also earns good deeds for the souls of the dead. But then, as I write later in the book, you have multiple sort of outdoor prayers that also people organize in the summer according to the local ritual calendar. These prayers are also called Dova. And there, it's linked to agricultural practice. So you perform prayers for rain, which is again linked to your daily sort of production of your food. So it's all intertwined. Really.
I'm really interested in the chapter that you have called Halal Exchange, and I know that you have an article published on this as well. It surprised me to read about the attitudes toward the imams from the neighborhood. So, right, I mean, you have this concept of kamshiluk, right? Mm-hmm. This idea of the neighborhood. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the relationship between the neighborhood and its concepts of exchange, living the halal way, as you explained it? What is the economy in that sense, and what's the relationship with the world of the official imams, which they don't seem to like very much from your, at least the village that you studied?
Yeah, it's the kind of clash, basically, what we used to call between orthodoxy and orthopraxy, between the world of imams and the world of, sort of everyday sort of practitioners. But sure, so Komşuluk, which comes from Turkish, original Turkish word for neighborhood, again, as a particular history in the debates on Bosnia. But what Komşuluk basically means is a kind of moral conception of neighborhood. What does living in proximity, physical proximity with others, entails? And it entails that you take care in the lives of others, your neighbors, your next door neighbors, and so on. As I develop or write about in the book. When it comes to halal exchange, what I mean by it is that that people again do take care of their neighbors by basically doing things for others, not expecting immediate return for that. So it's a kind of vernacular term for generalized reciprocity in which everyday life is sort of embedded. And in the chapter Halal Exchange, I write about the feast of sacrifice, that is an annual important Islamic ritual. It takes place 2 months and 10 days after the end of Ramadan, when Muslims go on the pilgrimage to Mecca. And what people do locally is that they do sacrifice an animal, usually a ram, and 1/3 of the sacrifice is kept by the family, 1/3 is given to the poor, and 1/3 is given in the neighborhood to your neighbors. And that's where the exchange basically emerges, because there's a particular sort of aesthetic of giving, where basically you have to bring a piece of sacrificed meat to the doorstep of your neighbors, and you have to exchange words. So you are saying halal osum, and they have to reply kabal osum, which basically then means you don't owe me anything. That's mm-hmm. the kind of like performative aspect yeah. of the ritual.
A sense of debt, right?
Exactly.
Or not being indebted, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There is no debt kind of created. You don't owe me anything. That's the kind of crucial moment. And what's really important is that, well, you would expect, oh, you just came here so I can give you something back immediately. But it never happens. You need to take your piece and go back to the neighbor, to his doorstep,
yeah.
and perform it basically again. And what I realized afterwards is that the same kind of words also are exchanged when villagers are helping each other in everyday life. So when you, for example, need to bring to get firewood from the forest and you don't have a tractor, let's say, and you ask a neighbor to help you, then the whole kind of exchange of help is basically performed by using the same vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And it's the same kind of way of performing that there is kind of no indebtedness in the relationship. Why is it important, or why I write about it? Because it can sound as some kind of idealized sort of world of equality and so on.
You've anticipated my next question.
Okay.
And yeah.
That's what I sort of found most interesting in a way in this sort of study. Otherwise, I'm sure I would be criticized for many things.
I think that's exactly what I wanted to ask about, because I've got a gender question lined up for you.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking at the end of your Halal Exchange chapter, you mentioned a couple of women and the situation of the dowry marrying outside of the village. So what does that mean? You have this old Turkish Arabic concept of miraz, right? And the dowry. Are there families in this arena of maybe idealized mutuality that are trying to marry their kin out of? I mean, how does that work exactly? I'm not sure I understand what happens when people leave the village or have an attachment beyond the village to Sarajevo.
So basically, why is this concept then important is that, first of all, as I write in the book, in the situation of increased inequalities, economic inequalities in the villages, these practices allow villagers in their everyday life to keep their relationship in somehow kind of less hierarchical, I will put it like that way, less hierarchical than they would normally perhaps seem. Yeah. So these practices taken from the ritual applied in the everyday context somehow sort of smoothen a little bit the hierarchies, especially between those who, for example, have these tractors and those who don't. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's a kind of important way of dealing with the kind of rising inequalities. And again, I'm sure some colleagues would see it simply as some kind of false consciousness, because obviously you don't get rid of hierarchies as such, which is true. But important is that it does work, for villagers. Yeah, they see that they can kind of get along despite the rising inequalities, exactly through some kind of shared language and shared moral idioms. What I write about in the chapter at the end, as you said, is that especially in the situation of indebtedness in the villages, people just try to, as I said at the beginning, try to get by, try to find a way to get by no matter what. And I give this example of two women who married outside of the village, mm-hmm. and who got a dowry. In order to renounce basically their share of the family land in the village.
Okay.
Because the ideology of inheritance in the villages is partible inheritance, so they technically should be given a fair share like their brothers, but cultural practice in the villages is that women move, at least in the past, move outside of the village, didn't claim their share, but were given dowry as a compensation. And I described the case of two women who were given dowry as a compensation, but because of their economic situation now, they were basically trying to claim the land back from their brothers. And it was deemed not as halal, but it was deemed as haram, basically, as something that is immoral. Yeah.
Right.
Because
right.
Because they when they accepted the dowry, they basically acknowledged that there is no debt, there is no demand on their part for the land, and 20 years later, they were making this claim. Land because of their individual economic precarious situation.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense to me. That makes sense. I wanted to ask you some questions about part two. So to make sure that we cover this section that you have about anxieties and the years of 1992 and 1995, could you share some of the stories about religious experience and religious practice? I have in mind here not just Ramadan and the importance of Ramadan, but how some of your interlocutors, or at least people that you interviewed, Sadetta, for instance, would be an example, see themselves in the village. What not identity per se, but how do they see themselves in their piety and practices? You have a wonderful part, I think, on dreams and the gift economy. So what are these roles, let's say, even visions of a better society for those who are prayerful and pious?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and it kind of goes to the heart of what I try to sort of say when it comes to thinking and writing about piety, because as I said at the beginning, on the one hand, writing about Islam and Muslim communities in Southeast Europe has been by and large reduced to the debates on identity politics, which again, you know, doesn't really kind of is not important that much in the villages where I've been working. But on the other hand, studying piety has been by many anthropologists in recent years reduced to these sort of individual practices of self-perfection, self-cultivation, that you have to sort of follow 5 prayers a day and, you know, all these sort of things. But that's not the kind of piety that would be sort of commonly practiced in the villages where I've been working, where the language of piety is more associated with, as you said, with Ramadan, for example, but also with participating in the outdoor annual prayers for rain, in as many prayers as possible. And they are organized according to the ritual calendar every week or so since the beginning of May till the end of August. And then there are these other practices, these other forms of piety that I write about and you mentioned, such as, for example, the practice of the dream incubation prayers called istikhara.
Could you tell us about that? It's really interesting. I've never heard of that, honestly. What is it?
Yeah, so actually dreams in Islam, it's a long history. So from early days of Islam, even the Quran was revealed to the Prophet of Muhammad through dreams. So dreams play an important part of Muslim lives everywhere, and there is some interesting literature on this topic, also anthropological studies, and dreams are important in Islam because they help Muslims in their everyday life with actually making decisions, making choices. And in order to do that, there's a particular form, this dream incubation prayer, which is called istikhara, where you pray a particular form of prayer before going to bed, and depending on what you then dream about, you sort of try to make sense or decide which choice is the right one. And people do practice it when it comes to making marriage choices, but also when it comes to taking exams, for example, or when it comes to dealing with particular afflictions. And as I write about this dream healer that I interviewed many times and met Sadhata, she also sees her role as someone who has been given this gift of dreaming for others, and
right.
and she links this gift from God with what is happening in the post-war society. The fact that neighbors are sort of nasty to each other, stealing from each other. And she sees her capacity to dream for others also as a way to somehow change or contribute to the change of society. So I, again, try to show how the religious, if you will, and the post-war and political economy are actually deeply intertwined. And people make sense through these particular imaginaries and vocabularies to their lives in the present, such as the healer and the people who actually do come and visit her and ask for help.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect way for us to turn to anthropology, or at least to return to what you're doing, both, let's say, in your empirical work and in your theoretical work. So as an anthropologist and really an ethnographer and ethnologist who's doing work on rural societies, I would very much like to see more work done in this vein. What would you like to see in terms of studies of this almost like a counter history? You use the term counter history toward your conclusion. Mm. How do you envision that? I mean, what would be your model or your advice for other people setting out and doing similar projects like this, whether it's in Bosnia or elsewhere?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think we would need another podcast to deal with that.
That's for a few more hours, David.
Yeah. but I have been for many years inspired by something what we might call anthropology or ethnography of history, and it's a relatively, I would say, established field of study in which anthropologists like Michael Lambeck or Charles Stewart, to name but just two, have been sort of thinking and writing about the ways in which people do make sense or make connections between the past, present, and the future in a culturally, if you will, specific ways. What are the cultural forms of mediation between the past and the present? Why is it important? Well, it is important because if you kind of follow your interlocutors, how they actually mediate between the past and the present, it often doesn't fit into the official historiographies, the language of official historiographies. It often spans across wider sort of historical sediments and strata than sort of mainstream sort of historiographies would, for example, sort of look at as being connected. So it kind of ignores the established periods, epochs, and so on. And thirdly, why I found it helpful is the fact that places like Bosnia, historiography of Bosnia, and anthropology of Bosnia as well, has been largely defined by particular critical events, the war, for example. And yet, what these counter-historicities kind of show is that rather than the war being, or these critical events sort of being as the defining moments of people's sort of ways of being in history, the counter-historicities sort of embrace these critical events as part of different temporalities, different ways of relating to the past in the present. So they really kind of offer an alternative way or alternative perspective on how people relate to the past in the present.
Yeah, and really, I mean, my follow-up question to that is the question about violence, because I you know, as a historian, I teach this obviously for the 20th century. I was interested in your chapter, especially on prayer, on praying and witnessing, how you capture stories, especially among women and wives and husbands in the village, how your interlocutors come to terms with the past, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the sort of, you know, German way of doing things, and it's been done to death. But there is an analogy here, or as you call it, analogical orientation. So, mm-hmm. what would happen, let's say, in these counter historicities if the centerpiece is not the war? That's mm-hmm. really like my way of being provocative, if I can. If the centerpiece for telling the stories of Islam or of Bosnian Islamic identity is not 1992. To 1995, or Yugoslav modernization in the 1960s from that period forward, what is it? I mean, what is then, let's say, the magnet or the lens through which to view everyday life? Mm. How would you read that?
Well, that's a great question, and I would say that. I mean, historical horizons, or horizons that people engage with to navigate this relationship between the past and the present, to define who they are, is obviously is historically conditioned, right? It's kind of shifting. So my honest answer would be that I don't know, because
I don't know either, David. Yeah. I really don't. I mean, if it's not Srebrenica, what is it? So I mean, long history, a cosmological sense of time. I think
what is important, what I try to show, is that there are interesting kind of configurations through which people do make sense of it. So the war obviously does play a very important part, but it the life experience cannot be reduced only to it, and that's the sort of main sort of point of, you know, I'm trying to make when I write in this particular chapter that you mentioned about Srebrenica. I juxtapose it with the local annual commemorative service for the martyrs from the region.
I noticed that funerals.
And there is a in the ritual calendar, there is a particular date for it, prayers for the martyr in Solun. And what I try to show is that this particular event is is as important as for example Srebrenica. Obviously, Srebrenica is the most important for my interlocutors because of what happened, the act of genocide. But it's not just that. There are also these local experiences of violence, since you ask about violence. But there are also, as I mentioned in other parts of the book, there are still villagers who remember, for example, Second World War, and what happened in these villages. Yeah, I mentioned my interlocutor, who unfortunately died a few years ago, but he was close to 100 years old when he died, and he was like 14, 15 when he experienced Chetniks attack on the village, how they were shouting, you know, burn the latrines so they can't even shit here anymore, and you know, these vivid memories of that. So these are all kind of repertoires with which people do make sense of these events. That's why the metaphor of badly parked car, right? It's something that is felt and experienced in all families. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a shifting horizon, basically. Yeah. So
yeah. That's perfect, David. And I want to ask, since we're sort of running low on time, really a two-part question that I like to ask of all my featured authors here at New Books Network. And the first one is what books you would recommend to our listeners, because we're on New Books in Eastern European Studies and New Books History and Anthropology, maybe two or three books you could recommend. And then finally, what projects or books or articles you're working on now?
Right. Well, that's a very difficult question, because there are so many great books out there. So I don't want to offend anyone who I will not mention, but I will mention one about Bosnia that was just kind of, it coincided the publication with mine, and it's a book by my colleague and friend Andrew Gilbert, which deals with humanitarian interventions in Bosnia after the war, and it was just published in August of this year. It's called International Intervention and the Problem of Legitimacy: Encounters in Postwar Bosnia. I think, when it comes to humanitarian interventions in Bosnia, it's the book to read. I would also mention a book that I find really interesting. It's also related to Bosnia, but not only to Bosnia. It was published either December last year or January this year. I'm always a bit confused about these dates, by Daryl Lee, who is an anthropologist and also attorney and lawyer from the University of Chicago. His book is called The Universal Enemy. And he traced foreign fighters, sometimes also known as mujahideens, but it's not necessarily the right label, but who actually spent some time in Bosnia during the war, but also in other wars since then, and he situates their life stories in the context of the global war on terror. So it's a really interesting book as well, Then the third book I will mention, which is related also to the things I'm working on at the moment, I'll mention Josh Reno's book called Military Waste. And he is looking into the military expenditure and military complex, especially in the US. He's looking at it from the perspective of wasting, so in terms of sort of money, how much money is spent on military preparation, but also what kind of waste in terms of materiality of military preparation is sort of created. And it's related to my new project, which is not completely new because I've published a couple of articles on it already. I'm interested in basically environmental, environmental damage and environmental consequences of military conflicts. What kind of landscape they create? It's linked to my experiences of work in Bosnia, where many villages where I've been doing field work are still surrounded by landmine fields. But not just landmine fields, but even trees in the forest are full of shrapnel and bullets and things like that. They create particular landscapes and military conflicts. So I'm sort of interested in the afterlife of this kind of military waste that has been left behind by the war. And it has its own social life as well. So, For example, the recent so-called migration crisis through the Balkan route, where there is a huge number of people stuck in northwest Bosnia on the Croatian-Bosnian border. It's in the areas that are now also full of landmines. So those guys who are trying to cross the border illegally are often sort of ending up in landmine fields. So it has these kind of unexpected consequences. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, David, for sharing those. I think our listeners will be really interested to follow up on that. I want to thank you for joining us, David. Really, this has been such a pleasure to talk to you about your book, and I hope we can do it again. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here at New Books Network, and we've been speaking with Professor David Hennig, who is the author of a new book, out with University of Illinois Press 2020. The book is called Remaking Muslim Lives, Everyday Islam in Postwar Bosnia and Herzegovina. Thanks for joining us, and we'll hear from you again.